Steve Turner is on the line with us from London, author of A Hard Day's Right, The Stories Behind All the Beatles Songs and the Gospel According to the Beatles. Steve, when you think of the progression of Beatles albums, from 1967's Sgt. Pepper through to Magical Mystery Tour and Yellow Submarine and then to the White Album, what would you tell someone the White Album represents in the Beatles story?
I think the White Album was it was a bit of a marking time album. They'd come through the complexity of Revolver and Sgt. Pepper's and Magical Mystery Tour and all the experimentation. And I think hopes were high, like, you know, where can you go next? How complicated is the album cover going to be? How many layers is the music going to have? And really what they produced was something of a back to the drawing board almost. It was everything was stripped down. Lots of the songs were started acoustically. The cover, as you know, was designed by Richard Hamilton, and it's plain white. In many ways it did exceed people's expectations, but not in the way that they thought their expectations would be exceeded. And then they went on to, you know, the more complex approach on Abbey Road.
And what would you say about this notion that the White Album is like the introduction of the four Beatles individually as songwriters and performers?
Well, they had worked, I mean, they were increasingly working independently. I mean, John and Paul were increasingly writing songs on their own. But I suppose that was disguised to an extent on, you know, Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper. I mean, you still thought in terms of Beatles songs, and you imagine that John and Paul were sitting down at a piano or sitting down with two guitars and working out songs. But there wasn't really the pretense that was happening on the White Album. I'm not sure that at the time I thought of it that way. In retrospect, you can see that they're very much, individual contributions. But, a lot of that's in retrospect as we've learned who actually had the major contribution to each song, and there have been so many interviews since. At the time, I just accepted it as another Beatles album. And I think, to me, at the time, and even now, it has very much the approach of a sketchbook. It's like kind of ideas, some of them not completely finished, but kind of little, you know, directions they could have taken. And things were not done in the sort of polished way that earlier records have been done.
So, Steve, we're going to start with Back in the USSR and Dear Prudence back-to-back, cuts 1 and 2 on side 1. What do we know about how these two songs came about?
Well, Back in the USSR was mainly a Paul song. And, I mean, the whole thing about the White Album is a huge percentage of the songs were actually written when they were in India. I mean, it was really the last time that all four Beatles were together and had leisure time, you know, had time to sit around and play songs to each other in a relaxed environment. And Mike Love of the Beach Boys was there, as was Donovan. And they had these great sort of jam sessions going on. And Mike Love said to Paul, wouldn't it be great to do a song about the Soviet Union in the style of Chuck Berry's Back in the USSA? Back in the USA. And so they, you know, Paul started this song that was a kind of a pastiche of Beach Boys and Chuck Berry, extolling the virtues of the Soviet Union rather than the USA. You know, that was the whole joke of it. And of course, when it came out, there were some people that were already suspicious of the Beatles and their, possible leftward leaning, who thought this was terrible that they would sing a song in praise of the USSR. They didn't get the joke at all. Dear Prudence was also written at the Meditation Academy and was written about Mia Farrow's sister, whose name was Prudence. And she'd gone into the meditation almost like too heavily at first, you know, done too much meditation and had gone into almost sort of a trance-like state and was staying in her bungalow longer than she really should. And John wrote this song that basically said, hey, come out, you know, enjoy life. And so it's a very personal song addressed to her.
Next on side one, Glass Onion, then Ubla Dee, Ubla Da. to London and Steve Turner. What about these two, Steve?
Well, Glass Onion, that was an interesting song because it was part of what prompted it was a letter that John was sent by a pupil at his old school in Liverpool. I think it was part of an English lesson or something. He'd written and said, you know, could you tell us how you write your songs and what the meanings are? Actually, this guy, it turned out a few years ago, I found out his name's Stephen Bailey, and he's a sort of a design guru in England now. And I was able to photocopy the relevant song in my Hard Day's Right and send it to him. Anyway, he wrote this letter to John, and John, he wrote quite a nice letter back saying, well, people attach all these sort of meanings to songs that I never intended in the first place. And then he thought he'd write a song that actually was, you know, a complete trail of red herrings, basically, just sort of images that would lead people into speculation. And he'd kind of either made them at randomly, or some of them had origins in real places or incidents, like the cast iron shore is a beach on the River Mersey in Liverpool, and the bent back tulips. Derek Taylor told me that there was a restaurant in Knightsbridge called Parks, and the owner had tulips on each table, and he used to actually bend the petals back, and so that image came from that. But they're basically kind of grabbed out of the air to confuse people. And Obladi Oblada, that's a Paul song again. He certainly started that in Rishikesh in India, but it was based on a phrase that a guy called Jimmy Scott, who was a conga player from Nigeria, he'd been using this phrase quite a lot. He'd shout out Obladi, and the crowd would shout back Oblada, and then he would say life goes on. And he actually had a band called the Obladi Oblada Band, and Paul loved the phrase and kind of built a song around it and gave it a kind of a Jamaican reggae ska beat. And actually Jimmy Scott got in touch with him after it came out and demanded money, and there was some sort of financial resolution was made at some point.
And then rather famously, I think Paul made his bandmates play this one countless times in the studio till they were quite sick of it, I'd read someplace.
Yeah, I don't think it wasn't a favorite song of John's, I know that.
All right, we'll jump ahead on side one. Let's go down to George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and then John Lennon's Happiness is a Warm Gun. Steve, both of these songs were born when each writer's eye was drawn to a phrase on a written page, is that right?
Yes, that Happiness is a Warm Gun and While My Guitar Gently Weeps would be actually connected in that sense, that they both came from a random sighting of words on a page. In George's case, he was into the I Ching and the idea of randomness, and he just picked a book off the shelf of his mother's home and opened it at a certain page and saw this phrase, Gently Weeps, and just built the song around that phrase. John, Happiness is a Warm Gun, was apparently used as an advert. That phrase was used as an advert in an American gun magazine that George Martin had in the studio. And obviously based on the Charles Schulz Snoopy phrase, you know, happiness is never having to say sorry, I think.
No, let's see. No, it was Happiness is a Warm Puppy.
Oh, right. Okay. So I'll rephrase that.
Yeah.
Happiness is a Warm Gun was actually a phrase taken from a gun advert, or an advert in a gun magazine, that caught John's eye. I think it belonged to George Martin and was lying around in the studio, and was based on the Charles Schulz Happiness is a Warm Puppy phrase. And John liked the you know, he liked the fact that it had happiness and gun in the same phrase. He thought that was a strange thing to use. But the song is actually made up of three different songs that were kind of started and not finished, which you know, that became a technique they used quite a bit, actually using two or three, well, A Day in the Life, that used two or three unfinished songs and jammed them together. So this was a technique that they were starting to use.
I think your book said that several Beatles insiders were tossing in some of the lines when John was writing it. Isn't that part of that story as well?
That's the soap impression and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for a certain part of Happiness is a Warm Gun, I know John was with Derek Taylor, who had been their press officer, and he worked at Apple, and they were throwing around random phrases, and Derek had some story about, he met a guy in a hotel who said that when he went out with his girlfriend, he liked to wear black gloves or something, and he introduced that phrase about the velvet glove in Happiness is a Warm Gun, and there were several other phrases that Derek had thrown in.
Let's see. I'm looking down here. Let's move on to side two of the first disc. It starts with a jaunty Paul McCartney tune and then a languid John Lennon tune. Steve, what can you tell us about these two?
You'll have to tell me what they are.
Okay, let's see. That's Martha, My Dear.
Right.
And I'm So Tired.
Martha, My Dear I think that sort of grew out of a Paul piano exercise. I mean, technically that's where it grew from. But he did have an old English sheepdog that was called Martha, so that gave the title. I mean, it wasn't a real girl, and it's certainly not a song about a dog, but I mean, that's where the phrase Martha came from. I'm So Tired, again, is a John song written out in Rishikesh. And, you know, that I think he was tired. Mind you, he had written quite a few songs that alluded to tiredness in some way. I mean, he seems to have liked his bed in that way. But I think when they were out in Rishikesh meditating for sometimes 6 or 7 hours on end, and the fact that they'd escaped from all the... you know, all the showbiz whirl in London, I think there was a kind of arrestedness more than the tiredness, but that's John talking about Rishikesh.
Could you say a word? I think your book refers to the Martha song being a bit about the waning days of Paul's relationship with Jane Asher.
Right. I can't remember the specific lyrics now to comment on that.
Martha, My Dear, Remember Me,
Don't
Forget Me,
okay,
that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, Martha, My Dear could be a reflection on his relationship with Jane Asher, because he certainly wrote a number of songs about Jane right from the beginning to the end. You know, We Can Work It Out and I Love Her. You could probably do a whole album of Paul songs just about Jane Asher. She was a great inspiration to him in that way, and certainly the Asher family were a great inspiration in many other ways, because that introduced Paul to the kind of intellectual life of London, which was a complete contrast to his own working class background in Liverpool.
Onward on side two, we'll pair Blackbird from Paul and Piggies from George. Steve, what can you tell us about these two?
Blackbird was written by Paul. Now, he says the tune came from a classical tune that was in a sort of teach yourself guitar songbook that he and George had when they were teenagers. I mean, it's hard to actually detect that influence, but I think what Paul was meaning was, like, by trying to play this classical piece and then sort of altering it a bit, he came up with this beautiful new tune. I was told a story by Paul's stepmother that he'd actually written it. He'd actually tape recorded a Blackbird singing and tried to transcribe it. As Paul's never mentioned it, I'm not quite sure of the validity of that. But it seemed, you know, a very definite story that she told me. I think it also, you know, lyrically alluded to what was going on in America at the time, which was, you know, the death. Well, assassination of Martin Luther King and the race riots in America. So it alluded to social conditions in America as well, and it was a kind of an endorsement, a song of encouragement to the African-American community in America. Piggies was a George song. I think it was meant semi-humorously, but it was, you know, it was attack on the bourgeoisie, you know, calling them pigs in the same way that Orwell sort of used the pigs to refer to the ruling class in Animal Farm. Unfortunately, it's one of those songs that Charles Manson took a little bit too literally. And, you know, when George sings about the knives and forks and attacking the piggies, you know, Manson took that seriously. And in fact, they scrawled piggies in blood at some of the sites of the murders, the Manson family murders.
And Harrison was, of course, horrified when he heard that, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's going back to Glass Onion. That sort of intensity that was focused on the Beatles songs at that time, where people saw unintended meanings and meanings that just weren't there.
Moving on with side two, here comes Rocky Raccoon, Don't Pass Me By, and Why Don't We Do It in the Road? We'll toss that one in too. Beatle author Steve Turner, what's the headline on where these songs came from?
Rocky Raccoon was, that was a Paul song, and it was again written out in Rishikesh. I think one of the things about the songs on the White Album was they often returned. I mean, Hunter Davis pointed this out in his biography of the Beatles back in the 60s, that when they were in India, strangely enough, their minds turned back to Liverpool and childhood and things like that. And, you know, Rocky Raccoon's basically a cowboy song. And it shows Paul's sort of inventiveness and his ability to make up, create characters and stories, which he was always very good at. John wasn't as good at doing that. You know, John would deal more with sort of emotion and feeling, and Paul kind of avoided emotion and feeling, really, and tended to make up stories. And they had Donovan at hand, who was teaching them sort of new acoustic guitar techniques. Why Don't We Do It in the Road was a song, again, a Paul song, a complete contrast to what you expect of Paul if you think, you know, he can only write Yesterday. Very sort of loud, attacking, primal song. Written in Rishikesh, he saw the monkeys out there mating and thought, you know, why aren't we like the monkeys? Why do we attach such shame to making love, whereas the animals don't? That was his reasoning behind the song. I didn't include this in the gospel according to the Beatles, but when I thought about it in retrospect, I think it could be quite a profound song, because by saying why don't we do it in the road, it's kind of it's saying why are we not like animals? You know, what differentiates us from the animals? And very often we don't do things because we think somebody might be watching us, but because that song says, you know, why don't we do it in the road, no one will be watching us, why don't we do it in the road? So it sounds like a very trivial question, but it could be the most profound question. You know, why don't we behave like animals? I actually went out to Rishikesh about a year ago, and I did see all those monkeys. They're still walking along the walls of the old ashram. What was the third song?
That's right. Don't Pass Me By.
Oh, Don't Pass Me By was a Ringo contribution. And when I was listening to some old interviews the Beatles had done, old radio interviews from the 60s, there was one from 1964 in Australia where Ringo is shouting in the background about a new song he's written, and it's Don't Pass Me By, and Paul's saying, oh, you know, I don't know if we're going to put it on the next album. But that just shows you how long that song had been knocking around, you know, like 5 years before it actually got released on an album.
Side two closes with two acoustic gems, I Will from Paul McCartney and then Julia from John Lennon. Steve, tell us about these two.
Julia and I Will, I mean, there's a similarity in that they're both songs written by, one by John, one by Paul, about the most important women in their lives. I think I Will was about Linda, because Linda Eastman at the time, came into Paul's life shortly after their stay in Rishikesh, when they come back to England. And in fact, she was in the studio for some of the recording of the White Album. And Julia was written by John about his mother, who was certainly the most important woman in his life. The first two lines of Julia are actually taken from a poem by Kahil Gibran. In fact, it's almost word for word. So he's used that as a starting point for the song.
And just a word about Julia, John's mom. She had left John and then had been killed. Could you just recount that in a sentence or two?
Yeah, Julia John's mum was living somewhere else, not at John's family home. And
he was being raised by an aunt.
That's right, yeah, let me go back. that's right. John was living at home with his Aunt Mimi, and Julia was living not too far away with a guy. She actually didn't marry him, but he was as good as a husband to her at the time. And Julia would come over periodically to see John. And she'd come over this day, and John wasn't in for some reason. And she left the house, crossed the road, and was hit by a car and was killed. And I think John was about 17 or 18 at the time. It was a terrible blow to John. And you know, you can attribute a lot of John's sort of bitterness and his misogyny, I think, to that happening. Maybe he never would have become the songwriter he became if that hadn't have happened.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Steve, we'll move now to what's known as side three. I think I'm right on this. Side three, birthday and your blues back-to-back pack quite a wallop to start it off. What about these?
Right. Birthday, again, a song written by Paul. He wanted to do something in emulation. There was a song called Happy Happy Birthday, which was a rock and roll song in the 50s, and he wanted to do just a celebratory birthday song that was kind of really hard rock. And they'd been watching that film, The Girl Can't Help It, I think, at the time. And that might have influenced him, because that had Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis and people like that in. So it might have influenced him to go right back to a primitive rock and roll song, but it's incredibly loud and raucous. In fact, when he did it in concert recently on a tour that I saw him on maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I mean, he did a brilliant version of it. Got the piano, you know, exactly the same as on the album. Year Blues is, you know, it's John sort of mocking the blues idiom, but in fact singing a blues song. He was going through a really tough time, again, written out in India. His relationship with Cynthia was coming to an end. Yoko was on the scene. Yoko was writing him letters, he was receiving those letters at the camp. Probably they were coded or something, because all Cynthia would have known at that time is that Yoko was a Japanese artist who was approaching John for money or, you know, some sort of backing. So he was in turmoil. You know, he was wanting to be with her, and he was with Cynthia, and he didn't know what the honourable thing to do was. So Year Blues was about that, and also it was the time of the British blues boom in the late 60s in Britain, and there were always these arguments in the music papers about, you know, could white people sing the blues? This would come up, you know, like every month somebody would be this argument about, you know, whether white people could, or, you know, authentically sing the blues. So it was part of that.
Right. Let's see. Mother Nature's Son and Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey are next. Those monkeys again, Steve.
Yeah.
Nature's Son.
Sorry, what was the first one?
Mother Nature's Son.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mother Nature's Son was written by Paul, again in Rishikesh, result of a lecture by the Maharishi, which must have been to do with nature. And John wrote a song at the same time, similar theme, but he actually had the tune which he used on Jealous Guy. He stripped off his lyrics and turned it into Jealous Guy, but they'd both done these songs about nature, and Paul's was the one that made it onto the album. He was also, he was thinking of a song by Nat King Cole as well, which is called Nature Boy, which he'd always liked when he was a kid. And Paul was a great nature lover. Although he grew up in Liverpool, you always think urban city, but you only had to go a few miles outside of where they lived in Liverpool, and you had countryside, and you could see the mountains of Wales from, you know, high points just around. So he always loved nature. Yeah, Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey. Again, that was about John and Yoko, and I think was about the sort of turmoil that they were caught up in, and Yoko was not really a welcome guest in the eyes of the other Beatles. It was the first time a woman had sort of come into the Beatles setup and not been willing just to be a girlfriend, you know, and to see the Beatle at appointed times, but actually wanted to be in the studio and wanted to make a contribution and even wanted to help out writing lyrics and things like that. And they didn't really like it. And I think that sort of spelt the beginning of the end. There's the Come On, Come On, Come On at the beginning, I think, was taken from a track by the Fugs called Virgin Forest. There's kind of a chorus on the beginning of that, which I think inspired that that part of the song.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Next we would move to, okay, here we go. Let's play the three that end side three now. Sexy Sadie, Helter Skelter, and Long, Long, Long. Steve Turner, these three for us, please.
Yes, Sexy Sadie was, if it wasn't actually written in Rishikesh, it was certainly written as a result of Rishikesh, because it was actually written as Maharishi, you know, you made a fool of everyone. They thought that was too libelous, and so they changed it to Sexy Sadie. There'd been a falling out between the Beatles and the Maharishi. They suspected him of, I think, exploiting them, basically. You know, he had ideas for doing a film and wanted to use their name, and there were ideas for sort of taking 10% of people's incomes, which, you know, is okay if you're just a dentist or something, but if you're a Beatle, that's going to be a lot of money. So there was a kind of division going on there, and they basically left under a bit of a cloud, and Sexy Sadie was one of the first songs that was completed after they left. Helter Skelter was... that was written mostly by Paul as a result of a review in one of the British music papers of a single by The Who. And this review said, you know, this is the most noisy, loud, fast rock and roll song you'll ever hear. And then when Paul heard the song by The Who, it didn't seem like that at all. And he thought, well, you know, I'm going to write a song that would actually live up to that description. And so he wrote Helter Skelter. And of course, Helter Skelter is a kind of fairground attraction where you climb up this tower and you slide all the way down it, you know, going round and round the apparatus. And I guess Charles Manson didn't realize what a Helter Skelter was, and that's another of the songs that he took as being personally addressed to him and was a call to sort of hide in some underground caves while the revolution went on, and then you know, come back when it was all over and take over the world. What was the third song?
Long, Long, Long.
Long, Long, Long was written by George, and he wrote it after, well, not after hearing, but it was certainly based on, the chord changes were based on Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, on Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde double album. Sounds like a love song. I guess it is a love song in a way, but he said, in retrospect, he said it was a love song to God.
Which was something we would come to be used to in George's writing as time went on.
Absolutely, yeah.
Side four now. Side four starts with Revolution Number One, which was unusual because all of us had heard Revolution as a single released some months before, and then there's this loping version of it here. Hmm. Let's talk about Revolution Number One on its own first, Steve.
Well, Revolution was John, and at this time the kind of the drugs and Eastern mysticism, certainly for John, was disappearing, and what was coming in its place was like political revolution. He'd always been attracted to left-wing politics, and left-wing activists had always been interested in John. So he'd met with people like Tariq Ali and different people involved in left-wing magazines in the UK. And people like that would try and, you know, see if they could get money from him or sponsorship from John. And it's really a song to those people. He's saying, yeah, you know, I've got the same ideals as you. You know, I'd like to change the world, wouldn't we all? But I don't really believe in revolution that sheds blood, you know. The kind of revolution that I'm interested in starts within, you know, it starts within your mind, your consciousness. So, you know, the song disappointed these left-wing people because they thought he was, he's really not joining them in the way that they wanted him to join them, and that they didn't really care to be told, you know, you got to change your head, you got to change your mind instead.
Yeah, it does. It raises the philosophical question about revolution in general, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's see. We're going to roll that, and then we're going to roll three Honey Pie, Savoy Truffle, and then Cry Baby Cry. So Honey Pie first.
Yeah, Honey Pie, Savoy Truffle, Cry Baby Cry. I suppose you could say what links those songs is a certain sort of innocence. It shows the Beatles had kind of one foot in the world of novelty songs, children's songs, the music hall, I guess, because Honey Pie was almost a tribute to the kind of music that Paul's dad used to like. And Paul's dad played in a jazz band and grew up in the 20s and 30s, and that was the kind of music that he liked, and Paul liked it too. Savoy Truffle is a kind of a joke of George's. It's about... there used to be these boxes of chocolates called Good News, and they all had different names like Cream Tangerine and Ginger Sling and Coffee Dessert. And Savoy Truffle was one of these, one of the chocolates in this box. Cry Baby Cry, that was based on a jingle that John heard on TV. I think it was a jingle for like maybe nappies or washing powder or something like that. And he just heard this Cry Baby Cry, and he writes... what's almost like a nursery rhyme, I guess. This was another thing that fascinated the Beatles. I mean, Yellow Submarine, in a sense, is a kind of a nursery rhyme. And you could probably, again, you know, along with your Paul McCartney love songs to Jane Asher, you could probably have a Beatles album of nursery rhymes as well.
Actually, I have done that. I made a CD for my sister when she had her kids. It was basically a CD of the... Beatles songs for kids, yeah. And it had,
well, there's enough.
There's plenty of those, yeah. So, very excellent. We're coming closing in now. Revolution number 9. You know what a soundscape. What can you tell us about this adventure on the Beatles' White Album?
Well, Revolution number 9 was really John's idea. Although Paul had also been doing these kind of cut-ups with pre-recorded tapes. I mean, you're in the, you know, in those days the studios only had, you know, 2-4, I don't even think they're into 8 tracks at that time, so you couldn't do much experimentation like you can now with sampling and you know what you can do with digital technology. And so to cut up a tape or run a tape back was very exciting.
A little flavor of that, there's a little flavor of that on like Tomorrow Never Knows, isn't there?
Yes, yeah. This was, as Tomorrow Never Knows was to Revolver, this was to the White Album. It was the track that you went, well, you know, what on earth is that? Does it really fit on a Beatles album? It was as though they'd allowed themselves a few minutes to go completely wild and experimental. So it's a collage of all kinds of tapes that they'd found. One of them being the tape that had a voice going number 9, number 9, which I believe was some sort of... it was a test for like a music academy or something like that. It was like, I guess this was question number 9. And number 9 was actually a favourite number of John's. You know, I think he was born on October the 9th, and he lived at number 9 in a street in Liverpool. And 9 seemed to crop up quite frequently in his life, and he attached some kind of mystical importance to the number 9.
And then the whole enterprise ends with this sort of Hollywood arrangement of Good Night. What can you tell us about the development of that song?
Good Night is a very sentimental sounding schmaltzy song written by John. I suppose coupled with Revolution Number 9, it's probably Revolution Number 9 and Good Night are probably the two most un-Beatles sounding tracks on the album. And Ringo sang it. You see, John did write sentimental songs for... he wrote Beautiful Boy for Sean, so he wasn't beyond writing that sort of thing. And it sounds slightly like True Love, the Cole Porter song, which is in the musical High Society, sung by Bing Crosby.
I think George Harrison covered that later, too. It might have been a favorite of the band.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Well, very good. Anything else just to put a punctuation on how you feel about this record, or even a personal remembrance? I'm trying to recall. I think we're age contemporaries, roughly. You're in your 50s now, yeah?
Yeah. Well, Paul always said he liked albums. He liked the idea when an album came out that you went out, you're excited to buy it, and you actually got something that you were really pleased to own. I don't just mean the music on it, but the physical product of the album. So, you know, on Sgt. Pepper's, you had the gatefold sleeve and the little cardboard sheet that came out with cutouts, and the inner sleeve was all coloured in you know, psychedelic reds and pinks. He liked the fact that you'd buy it and you'd actually love this product. And it's very similar, I can remember, when I bought the White Album. Because, again, it was a gatefold sleeve, but it had a number printed on it, you know, which made out, I don't know, I hope all the numbers were different, but each album had its own identity. And then there was a big fold-out poster inside that had all the lyrics on, and all kinds of candid snapshots of the Beatles done in a sort of a collage. So it was an exciting product to hold. As I mentioned earlier, I went out to India about a year ago, and it was fun to go to Rishikesh and to actually find the academy, which is now all overgrown. It's locked up but overgrown, and I managed to find a guy to come and open it up and take me round. And it was interesting to see all these little cottages, which are now all, you know, the doors are off, the windows are broken. But, you know, this is where these great songs were actually written, and they sat on tops of roofs, and you know, to actually see the monkeys that were in the song, and to see the river, and to remember that as you walk from the academy into Rishikesh along by the Ganges, that's where Paul walked as he first sang "Oh Bloody Oh Blada." They went in a sort of a whole troop of them in a line, and Paul was at the front with his acoustic guitar singing "Oh Bloody Oh Blada." So it's fun to go back to the sources of those songs to see where they came from.
Sounds like a theme park in the making if somebody just wants to go and spruce the place up a little bit.
Yeah, if those buildings were in America or Europe, yeah, there'd certainly be a Beatles holiday camp or something. Yeah.